We'll turn with you to Revelation chapter 13. If you would turn with me to chapter 13 of Revelation, continuing in our studies in this book of the prophecy. This particular passage we read earlier, it should not be far divided from chapter 12. We are always in danger of detaching one chapter from another. But as ever, I would urge upon you to recall that this is one prophecy, and these things do belong together. Likewise, it also does continue. We finished perhaps in something of a dramatic fashion with that remarkable number, but it is not the end. There is so much more that follows into chapter 14 and beyond, of course. But just to remind you of what chapter 12 deals with, there we learn of the malice of the dragon towards the son of the woman, who we must conclude is Christ Jesus himself, his great malice against him, that child. And when he fails to conquer him, he then turns and pours it out upon the earth. That dragon who is described within the chapter in verse 9 as that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He sets about in a rage, we are told, in a great wrath, setting about to afflict the people of Christ on earth, the other offspring of the woman. And it is in chapter 13 that we read more about that assault that he takes out on God's people, and indeed on the earth as a whole. And as we come to chapter 13, it is perhaps a clear breakdown to look at the two beasts. And I would describe them in the first place as the worshipped beast. There are other descriptions as well, but I think this reflects what is being told us in the passage. The first comes from the sea, and he is worshipped. The second is from the earth, and he is working. He sets about the work of the first beast and of the dragon. So just a simple twofold division of the chapter to try and get a hold of it. The worshipped beast, first of all, and the working beast in the second place. So first of all, the worshipped beast, the one that is worshipped by the earth. As we begin this chapter, some of you may actually have another version open before you, another Bible version, and you might have noticed that some will say, "Then he, not I, stood on the sand of the sea." Now, normally, I might not place much upon this, I might not say much about it, but it does certainly describe things well if it is "he stood on the sand of the sea." It goes back to the different manuscripts that are available to us. Some have a different pronoun there. It's as simple as that. But we may well take it that he, the dragon, stood on the sand of the sea. In verse 17 of chapter 12, he was enraged with the woman. He went to make war with the rest of her offspring. Then he stood on the sand of the sea. And it fits so well. As John saw a beast rising up out of the sea, it's as though the dragon had gone there to welcome this beast and to summon him almost from the sea to take up his work. It would work also if John himself simply says that he saw it as he was there by the sea. But there was the dragon, enraged, raging through the earth. Let's just pause a moment. If you're here this morning you remember, that God warned Cain about the consequences of anger that is not dealt with. Here is the dragon, the devil, Satan, in a rage. And look what he's about. Perhaps should be a warning in itself that we should take all the more seriously. Here in chapter 13, we read of the way in which the dragon would do his work. He does it through his delegated authority, through his beasts. I would suggest that this is a demonstration that the rage of the dragon is not blind, it's not uncontrolled. Indeed, he has been raging through the earth since the very beginning of his sin against God, wherever that began. He's well practiced in his rage. It is not uncontrolled, because he is here calling these great beasts to do his work. He is calling them to give to them great authority. But do you see what's happening? When we read further on, there is the second beast who is doing great work in front of men. And he says, you believe in these works, then he points them to the first beast, and he says, worship this first beast. And where is the dragon? He's in the background all the time. He's not seen. He's not feared in the same way. It does say at one point that the dragon would be worshipped. But he's not the one that is the focus of the attention. The dragon is so clever. He's obscuring the reality, even in his rage. And so he calls up these beasts, and he gives to them power, throne, and great authority. Earlier, of course, in Revelation, we do read of power being given, but that it is given by God. That's not so in this passage. And it does reappear a number of times, so keep that in mind. The things that are given in this passage are given by the dragon. But remember that behind that is that the devil, who is the dragon, he can only ever give what's been given to him or permitted to him by God himself. Bear that in mind as we read, because if you were to take this, I think it's much like Daniel, who even after these things were explained, it was still troubling his spirit. And it can trouble your spirit. In some ways it should, to look at such pictures as these. But never forget. Yes, there's that series of delegations of authority, down to the second beast from the first, to him from the dragon. But where has the dragon got it from? It's only as God allows, only as God himself on high, even as we sang, that God permits. And so what do we find about these beasts that the dragon calls forth? The first beast surely was grotesque. Something of a combination of the four beasts that Daniel saw, that we read of in chapter 7 of Daniel. And just as there were there, there are symbols of power over men in this place. The crowns on the horns were of power, the crowns as well of authority. Notice the combination. Interesting that the crowns were not on the heads in this case, perhaps. But there on the heads was this blasphemous name, which we don't know any more about. But it was certainly defying God, as these names were so much in front of the men who would see the beast. So there was the symbols of power, the symbols of authority. But there was also another feature amongst the heads, one feature on one of the heads. In verse 3, I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And as you read on through the chapter, you find that this is the big identifying mark of this beast. This is the thing that seems to have attracted most attention. They worshipped the dragon. All the world marveled and followed the beast in response to that wound that was marked out. and he is described as the one who had this wound as well, that was an image was to be made to him. It's a disfigurement. Perhaps it was seen as a badge of honor won in battle. That's how wounds tend to be acquired, shall we say. But the thing is, it seems it has a morbid fascination to it. It was mesmerizing. It was the thing that gripped the people who looked on this beast. Yes, the beast itself was just indescribable. Make some attempt. It was like this, it was like that. But it was this wound, as if it had been mortally wounded. That deadly wound was healed. That was what was the marvel, the wonder about this beast that persuaded people to follow. The old word comes to mind, enthrall. We use the word enthrall. It's the captivation. But it carries more than it doesn't necessarily have a beauty to it. But there's something that even in its ugliness can capture the attention and grip it and hold it in thrall. But for all that, it wasn't a stupid enthrallment. They didn't lose their minds, the people who looked on this. They seem to have understood the significance of this wound. We read in terms of their worship in verse 4, with all this, the world marveled, they followed the beast, so they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast. Yes, they could see him there. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? Just seeing him in this way, with all his features, including that wound that had been healed, who is able to make war with him? After all, it's a deadly wound, yet it was healed. How can you resist such a creature? That you strike him as though he should be dead, and yet he's alive, strong, healed. Who can make war with him? And therefore the men serve him. They put pieces together. One and one makes two. And they said, who is like him? Because of the things that seem to be coming together that they see in him. Some folk have also made the point that this dragon, this beast rather, has come up out of the sea. That in itself was perhaps something that would draw awe from those who knew about this. The sea was a thing that brought real fear in that day. It was that deep, that turbulent unknown. And so put these things together. That beast was captivating, so that men would worship it. For many who have looked at Revelation and been familiar with Daniel, the temptation has obviously been very strong to try and pinpoint, is this a specific power that is represented by the beast? Just as in Daniel, we read, didn't we, that the one who explained things to him for a bit said, these great beasts, which are four kings which arise out of the earth. And then he asked about the fourth and all that followed from it. And there were going to be 10 kings who would arise, and another would arise after them. He would be different, and he will speak pompous words against the Most High, and so on. There are a lot of similarities here. But there was an explanation to say, yes, they are four kings, there are 10 kings, and so on. The temptation has been strong to try and do something similar to this. But that's not done here. Not in the way it was in Daniel. There was that interpretation that was given within its specific context in the day of Daniel. But Revelation is in a different setting. Yes, the language is similar. Perhaps because the vision itself was similar. But it's not described, not interpreted in the same way at all. But it may also be worth remembering that even if you were to think of Daniel when you come to this, the beast is a mingling of all the features of those beasts in Daniel. more or less. And perhaps that's a reminder that the specific powers that were told us in Daniel, let's think of them rather as intermingled in all its different parts and appearances, the different features and perhaps particular powers and approaches that were taken by the kings that were in mind in Daniel. But add to that this mortal wound that had been healed. That doesn't normally happen. The heads normally do, they normally are, and the crowns normally are a symbol of authority and power in this world. But it would seem to be an indication of something like this, that here was a fatal wound was inflicted, it should have died, but it wasn't, it was healed, it was up again, it was alive, strong. And it's perhaps a better indication of the powers that we do have and have had through all the ages. They do die. The Roman Empire, Gibbon's book, The Rise and Fall, and so on. Somebody wrote the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich as well, didn't they? They die, but another rises in its place. They die, they should be dead, this power, but it's alive again. It's this kind of power which the beast is living out in front of John. It's irrepressible. And perhaps that's the fascination of it. What then is it? Do we know? Well, the beasts in Daniel do represent state powers, and it may well be meant to represent the same here. As one empire crumbles, another takes its place. And very rarely are there genuine power vacuums. And I think the things that this beast does set about would also support that. Look at what he does. He has a mouth that is, he's given this mouth to speak great things. We read in Daniel pompous words, it means the same thing, great things, and blasphemies, and so on. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, putting God's name down, against his tabernacle, the place of his worship, against his name, and against those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. There was no place for God in the way that he was going. He had authority. He would keep it for himself. This perhaps points us in the direction of state authority in this world. But look too at what happens. He was given authority over every tribe, tongue, and nation. The beast was given nothing directly from God. He was given this by the dragon. The dragon is the devil. He is Satan. This authority was given to him from the same one who promised authority to Jesus, who promised to give Jesus all the nations. Jesus, he took up to the high mountain and he said, "Look, and I'll give you all this authority, their glory. It's been delivered to me, and I give it to whomever I wish," in Luke chapter 4. This was given to the beast. These were the earthly kingdoms. Remember, Jesus said it's, he answered in such a way that reminds us that he was not about this kind of kingdom, this kind of power. "My kingdom is not of this world." These kingdoms were, I think, as we find them here. It is commonly reckoned that this is a representation of state authority, state power, in its general sense. Here is the beast who would then overcome the saints, in verse 7. That's the kind of power that he would take. And what is the result? All who dwell on the earth will worship him. Except there's something more. Stop for a moment. It's not a very encouraging picture, perhaps, if we stop there. There's this awesomely ugly beast. There's this apparently complete power. There's even that dominance over the saints. to make war with them and overcome them. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him. Would you worship something like this? Many will. But take note, in the light of all that, the way that the prophecy marks out those who worship the beast, they're described in a particular way. And it tells us that it's not everyone who does worship. Yes, all who dwell on the earth will worship him, all, that is, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. That in itself is one of those delicate little touches in the record that remind us that all of this is in God's purpose. The Lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world, even his death, as it were, was in place from the foundation of the world. These are no mere accidents. It is God's purpose that's being worked out here. It's just so quietly spoken. But there's a real assurance for us here that yes, all will worship these ones who have not had their name written in this book of life. Let me remind you of another reassurance that we should take. There's that reference that comes back again in chapter 13. We've seen it on a couple of occasions before, to 42 months. In verse 5, he was given that mouth to speak great things and blasphemies, and given authority to continue for 42 months. He was given this all this authority. It was going on, he could do all of these things, but hang on a minute, it was for 42 months. No more. Yes, no less. He wouldn't take any less if he was given it, but it was for no more than that. There was a limit placed on it. He was given this authority because the dragon had this authority to give to him, but he only had it to give to him for 42 months, for that limited time, the time that God has purposed. And so we see that first dragon. We only touch on him. And then there is that further call in verse 9 that we have come across in earlier parts of the letter, also in Jesus' teaching in the Gospels. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. This thing is true. It's worth listening to. And perhaps it fits more clearly with what has to follow. You know all this. I'm telling you this. Just listen to this. Verse 10. Now these words are not easy to follow. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. But when you put it together with the concluding sentence, here is the patience and the faith of the saints, it would seem best to understand this, that this is a reminder, even to the saints, that yes, there will be great suffering ahead. Understand that. But that will be the demonstration of that patience and the faith of the saints. There are warnings of hardship and danger, and to endure them will be the characteristic of this, the patient and the faithful saints. It may not seem to be much comfort. There are these hard things coming. But the saints, the believers, are better off being prepared for it, as this word does. Within the midst of this awful authority of the beast, know that hard times are coming. But it is the way of patience to know that hardship, enduring it, is appropriate as a believer, as a saint. I must move on then to the working beast, the second one. Reminded and mentioned already, he comes up out of the earth rather than the sea. Is this so that he's less frightening? It would have been perhaps for the people of that time. He comes up looking like a lamb. He has two horns like a lamb. Have you seen a lamb with horns? Don't see it very often. You might see the little buds of horns, tiny little things in a lamb. It's not a full-grown ram or a sheep. It's just those little horns like a lamb's horns. They're pretty harmless, it would seem. Well, that seems to be what he's saying. This picture that he's using, two horns like a lamb. Just a little power, perhaps, signs of more that's hidden. But for all that, he spoke like a dragon. A dragon who was the deceiver, the slanderer, Satan, the accuser, that old serpent, the one who deceived the world. He spoke like a dragon. Perhaps we should be reminded of Jesus' warning that there would be those who would be in sheep's clothing, but there would be wolves to eat and devour. He wasn't coming with thunder, just a lamb, a lamb's bleat perhaps, but it was the speaking of a dragon, deceptive and blasphemous, as it was in verse 5. And the role of this second beast is to be the agent, shall we say, of the first. He was to exercise the authority of the first beast. We've read something of what that was going to entail in the first part. Now here comes the first beast, and he was going to apply it. He was going to get about that work, make it happen. There's something here that I think chills me to think of the way that the devil works. Such a harmless-looking thing, such damage that could be done. And at the same time, doesn't it firm your resolve that he's not going to get away with this? But even more than that is the trio, shall we say. I'm not the first to read through this passage and to note how often whatever the dragon does or the devil does is such a blasphemous travesty or parody of the truth. You see here three working together, administering the dragon's authority on earth. The dragon himself, the first beast, and the second. I don't want to take it too far, but there's just something chilling about it. It's all about deception. It's all about dragging people to worship the dragon. And it's blasphemy that they're about. Here are three creatures at the devil's work amongst men. Their aim is to get men to destroy themselves in the worship of the evil one. It's worship that Satan wanted most from Jesus when he tempted him. Since he can't lay hold of the Christ anymore, he'll pursue it with men. And in every way possible, he will set himself up as a substitute for God. Is he doing it in this awful trio of creatures? And here is the second beast. He then goes to apply the authority of the first. He seems to do it effectively. He brings men to worship the first, in verse 12, causes the earth to dwell, or those who dwell in it, to worship it. And since his great objective does seem to be that, to lead men to worship this first, this gruesome beast, perhaps it is right to understand that it is false religion. Is that what's represented here? It seems to cover most aspects of human life, where you have state authority, the world in which we live. You have also this false religion. And so much also taking the very things which God himself does rightly and misusing them. There is something of a priestly role, pointing men to say, worship this one. You must do this. Leading them to it. And so on. What a dangerous thing it is. But how deceptive it is. How tempting it is. How gentle it can be. But it can be so effective to bring men to false worship. He goes so far as to order that image of the first one to be made. He does great signs in verse 13, even making fire come down from heaven on the earth. There was one before. Do you remember Elijah, who called on God He wasn't making the fire on the altar, but that fire came down from heaven and burnt everything up, and it changed the hearts of the men who saw it. Here is a great beast with great authority, and this is what he does. How persuasive it is, because that's what he's about. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by the signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast. And because he's deceived them, his instructions are followed. He does secure that worship further by giving breath to the image of the beast in verse 15. How hard that is to understand. It is imagery that we have before us, of course. How else can one describe these things? But it was awesome to those who looked on, and they worshipped. But he also caused as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. It was a harsh regime that's in view here. There was that enforcement. If you don't, much like Nebuchadnezzar, if you don't worship this image, you will die. Further than that, he causes all, in verse 16, everyone, and there are a number of descriptions that mean to cover everyone, and cause to receive this mark on the right hand or on their foreheads. That's the, and it goes on, that no one may buy or sell. It's the economic factor. What does strike me as I read here, whether it be the worship of the image or the buying and the selling, there's not really much free choice left to man in all of this, is there? And yet men point the finger today at God for imposing on our freedoms. But that's just what the beasts are going to do for the sake of the dragon. If you come down to these verses of what are called the economic factor, and verse 17, for example, no one may buy or sell except if you have that mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Over the years, in churches, it seems this is one of the better known passages, but I suspect one of the least understood. I'm not sure that I can guide you exactly either. It is so difficult to know just what it is about. Very fascinating, I'm sure. But precisely because of that, it needs even more care in approaching it. I doubt that a literal mark is meant. I don't think it's necessary. I'm sure of that. History itself, which is what's being covered here, tells us that. Already in different points in history, steps have been taken which do not involve a literal mark on a forehead or on a right hand. Steps have been taken that have effectively and completely prevented people, God's people, from obtaining life's necessities. It was an effective way of destroying them. It was so in some places in the days of John himself. It has been today. I was just reading, I think it was just in the last year, in India. There was a village where there were some Christians, but there was a militant Hindu body, and they rose up and they tried to establish a boycott that no Christians in that village would be able to buy or sell a thing. And they didn't have a mark. They were well known. They were marked because of their life and their witness, which is exactly what we've read at the end of chapter 12, those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. That's sufficient mark. If you don't have that, then you are marked with the name of the beast. It will still be so somewhere on this earth at some time. And that number, the name, we're told in verse 18, is here is wisdom. If you have understanding, calculate the number of the beast. It is the number of a man. His number is 666. I would rather not say 666 because the words are there originally, telling us 666. We can write it out, perhaps, in numbers and so on. Thus far, no trick has been found to be absolutely sure of what name it might be or who it might be pointing to. There's no trick that has been found that anyone can reasonably be certain to have full wisdom to know this. except if we don't become preoccupied with the imagery of this thing. Remember, there are many claims that have been made. Remember what Jesus had to say about claims for things which are not clear to everyone? Jesus said it about his coming. And if it's not clear to everyone, it's not true. When he comes, it will be very evident. And claims of things that are not clear. Let's be very careful. We might say the simplest is best. Many people have come around to this place and they've said, well, if you're going to take a parallel, what about the number 7? 3 sevens. 7 is the perfect number. And on every count, 6 falls short. Some would say that. But even then, who knows? Perhaps it does fit the context. The context is of worship and of service. The challenge has been thrown out at the very beginning, where those turned, found the beast, they worshipped him and said, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? Is this a number that is saying, yes, that's what you might think. It seems a very, very powerful combination. But it's falling short, and it always will. Perhaps it is a reminder, if this is what we're to understand. Yes, there is this immense, this powerful beast that would seem to be unconquerable, but there is one who is perfect. He is not that one. And so just to take that brief glimpse of the features of this passage, and then to try and just wrap it up, I really must close. It's telling us in this chapter that the dragon, the devil, Satan, is serious about his efforts to overcome the offspring of the woman, the church, God's people. He's serious. He's desperate to undermine the name of Christ in all his blasphemy. And it tells us that he's immensely capable still. He has power. He can do great damage. And to some extent, he seems to have a free rein on the earth, it seems. But in another sense, as I read this passage, more and more, I see it's riddled with holes, you might say. It's not that we can dismiss him. You do that at great danger to yourself. But as the picture unfolds, he is desperately weak, and we must be encouraged, given courage. The beasts, they are awful things, but the beast is always a servant. Not the dragon himself, limited, cast out of heaven. Yes, the beast is powerful, but he's serving all the time. Notice he comes from the sea. Even a little thing like that, he rises up out of the sea. There is one who rules the sea with his voice. This is a creature, yes, like one that has never been seen before. It has no known kind to it. It has no belonging. And so we can go on. For all that the world and people of the world were marveling at his wound that had healed, he has been fatally wounded. Let's think on these things. It is a matter of passing through, if you like. They are part of the description. But for a moment at least, think on them and find courage. It has been healed for a time. But as with the 42 months, that time is not eternal. We've noted a number of other things already. The difference that it makes to have your name written in the Lamb's Book of Life. You will not worship the beast. You'll be kept from that. You will be marked for patience and faith, though in the face of brutality, of course. And from all of these, it's rather like they're interlacing this story that seems initially to be so formidable. But as these things run through it, take courage. Never stumble. Understand that even through this telling, yes, the foul means of the beast will overcome the saints, but there's a greater overcoming. Remember that the beasts, they're all about deception. It's not the truth. It will not last. This was a prophecy that came to the church of John's day. They were in the place of not being able to buy and sell at least parts of them. It was real. For you and me, it's probably frightening. What do we do then? Well, it may seem otherworldly, but it's the only way. It's to remember that that book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world is of far more importance than what we shall eat or wear. It is for us to trust in God. Jesus said it. Life is about more than that. Trust in this God. It is this God who has seen fit to give this power, this authority to the dragon for a time so that he can then give it to his beast, who gave it to a beast. But it's all in God's hands. And it is all just for 42 months. Precisely what that means. But it is leading to an end. It tells us that this God, we read in this chapter of what the dragon is going to do amongst the offspring of the woman, because he could not gain the son. We can read of the God who rescued his son. He will surely keep his people to the end, even of this. And so we take that a brief glimpse at the things that the Lord would reveal to us. May his word be a blessing to us again this evening.